Welcome to the Daily Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes, the editor of the Bulwark. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and lots of other places. And if you're so disposed, you can consider leaving a review. Over the weekend, a lot of folks were asking me about the name and about the ship that appears in our logo on the Bulwark website. So I tweeted out that it was, in fact, inspired by Longfellow, who wrote the poem about the ship of state. And somebody reminded me that back in 1941, Franklin Roosevelt had quoted that poem in a letter to Winston Churchill, who talked about it here.
The other day, President Roosevelt gave his opponent in the late presidential election a letter of introduction to me. And in it, he wrote out a verse in his own handwriting from Longfellow, which he said applies to you people as it does to us. Here is the verse. Sail on, O ship of state. Sail on, O Union, strong and great. Humanity, with all its fears, with all the hopes of future years, is hanging breathless on thy fate. What is the answer that I shall give in your name to this great man, the thrice chosen head of a nation of 130 million. Here is the answer which I will give to President Roosevelt. Put your confidence in us. Give us your faith and your blessing. And under Providence, all will be well. We shall not fail or falter. We shall not weaken or tire. Neither the sudden shock of battle nor the long-drawn trials of vigilance and exertion will wear us down. Give us the tools, and we will finish.
Not a bad mission statement, even if I'm engaging in a little bit of historical revisionism about why we picked the ship as a logo, which was actually picked before I had any idea that we were going to be here at all. But in any case, joining me today on the Daily Bulwark Podcast is National Review's David French.
We have so many things to talk about. Trying to chase the tail of Donald Trump's tweets over the weekend. But I first told our producer Jim that I wanted to talk with you, I was reading your piece about Tucker Carlson, which had generated a lot of conversation, including, you know, some of the folks who work around here were very, very impressed. They thought that, you know, Tucker Carlson was the voice of genuine populism. And you were not buying that. In fact, your piece suggested that conservatives should reject Tucker Carlson's victimhood populism. Let's talk about the victimhood populism. That Tucker Carlson engaging in, and why this is not the authentic voice of the conservative movement.
Yeah. So let's first say what I responded to was Tucker Carlson, and here's why I have to say that very carefully and plainly, because the debate has sort of spun out like this. Tucker Carlson said a lot of things that were not true. Then I responded to the things that Tucker Carlson said that I believe were not true. Then a number of people are sort of Tucker's defenders, and this is a sort of a mirror of the arguments we often have about Trump, didn't actually defend what Carlson said. They defended a better version of what Carlson said. Mm-hmm. And so
These were the Carlson explainers.
So you had this sort of Carlson cry from the heart about populism that said a number of things that I think illustrate the problems with populism. And then you had a secondary set of arguments that were like, well, let's ignore exactly what Carlson said for a minute and talk about what I want to talk about, which is all well and good and everything. But, you know, we need to define our terms when we're talking about what you're responding. And what I was responding to with Carlson was essentially an argument that essentially did this. It took results of an enormous number of really important cultural and religious and economic trends, took the end results of all of them, which have many different causes, many of those causes far out removed from the control of domestic American politics, and turned all of that into a story of what the man is doing to you. And that's just a fundamentally false reading of history. It's a fundamentally false way of looking at the world, and it's a a way of looking at the world that creates a victim mentality. It says, well, if only we had a different man up there, then he's going to stop inflicting all of this on me. And that's not the way the world is working.
Now, you agreed with some of the things he said, you know, that people long for connection with each other, that we can't separate economics and family life into distinct spheres, and that men do suffer from a unique challenge in modern American life. So you did have some common ground with him there. But where do you really diverge?
Yeah, I did have common ground because I think, you know, what he did do was I diagnosed some accurate problems in the American body politic in America. What I disagreed with him on was the cause, and to the extent that he articulated a solution, the solution. So it's about like going to a doctor, and you have two doctors, both can identify the symptoms that the patient has, but one of the doctors is just wrong about the cause, and then therefore wrong about the course of treatment. So yeah, it was. I think it's important to talk about what are the patient's symptoms. But that's only part of the battle. We need to figure out why they exist and what we can do about them.
Okay. I mean, he says, for example, that manufacturing has all but disappeared over the course of a generation.
Yeah, and that's just false. American manufacturing, we are producing more than we used to, substantially more. We're producing more than we did one or two generations ago, substantially more. But we have far fewer people as a percentage of the workforce working in manufacturing. So you have to grapple with that truth. How is it possible to produce more and have fewer employees? Is that the man keeping you down? Or is that one of the many disruptive effects of new technology? And if you try to rein in the disruptive effects of new technology, say by reining in the very existence of that technology in the manufacturing process, do you then price yourself out of competitiveness. None of that was really addressed. It was sort of the blanket view that manufacturing has collapsed, when the reality isn't that manufacturing has collapsed, it's that manufacturing employment has decreased. And those are different things.
He also casts American boys as a generation of burnout, something that also the man has done to us. So you take issue with that.
Right. Well, I took issue with two parts of that. One was generation burnout, and the other one was that the drive to decriminalize marijuana is driven by politicians who want money from marijuana, which is, I think, just objectively, empirically absurd. So I don't doubt that legalizing marijuana will, over time, and maybe even over the short term, lead to an increase in marijuana use. The question about decriminalization wasn't, do we want more people using marijuana or not? It was, are the costs of criminalization greater than the costs of decriminalization? And the costs of criminalization include enormous law enforcement resources, include the damage done to people's lives through mass incarceration. It includes the threat to civil liberties by an overexpansive drug war. All of those things are real costs, and they're real costs that we've borne as a society without stamping out marijuana use. And in fact, marijuana use in an atmosphere of total criminalization has been higher in the past than it is now with a environment of partial decriminalization. And so none of that has been dealt with. It's just that it's treating, you know, people like me who've changed their minds on this subject as if we're in the grips of the cash from Big Reefer. I've yet to see any cash from Big Reefer, for the record.
Why did you change your mind about this?
I changed my mind about this. I would say pretty definitively in the 2016 timeframe. I kind of transitioned from a point of view where I was firmly in favor of criminalization to a point where I just didn't care about the issue. And then began to be more alarmed at the criminal, at the incarceration of nonviolent offenders, that's when I began to be more firmly on the side of decriminalization.
So he also talks about the elites, the wealthy Americans who just really don't care about the average American. And he said, those very same affluent married people, the ones making virtually all the decisions in our society, are doing pretty much nothing to help the people below them get and stay married. Rich people are happy to fight malaria in Congo, but working to raise men's wages in Dayton or Detroit, that's crazy.
See, you know, again, this is... This is something where I think that, you know, Tucker, for all of his populism, I feel like he's just out of touch outside of his elite coastal cocoon that he lives in. If you spend much time
which
at all.
Which he actually does, by the way. See, I live in Mequon, Wisconsin. You live in Tennessee. And we're being lectured about, you know, what we don't understand about America from a guy that lives within a cocoon that we will never be admitted into.
So I just very quickly, I say, what are the stats of philanthropy in the U.S. and giving to international charities versus giving to domestic charities? And it's an imperfect measure because, of course, total giving in the U.S. includes giving by people who are poor and middle class as well as upper class. But if it is really true that married Americans care about the Congo and they don't care about Detroit, you would at least expect to see some sort of skew towards international giving. And the reality is only about 6% of the American charitable dollar goes to international charities. A whopping 94% goes to domestic charities. That's, again, it's an imperfect measure. But when you're talking in broad brush terms where you're saying, well, you know, you just don't care, it's false. I mean, I grew up in rural Kentucky. I was raised my kids for most of their childhoods in rural Tennessee. I'm extremely familiar with the charitable efforts being undertaken to reach people in rural America. I'm extremely familiar with the charitable efforts undertaken to reach people in urban America. I've volunteered for Big Brothers programs. I have volunteered for homeless ministries. I have helped run a church ministry in rural Kentucky that was specifically oriented towards reaching out to poor and struggling and working class kids. I've done all of those things, and the idea that Americans who are fortunate, who are blessed to have some degree of prosperity, just don't care about other Americans, specifically poor and working class Americans, is fundamentally false. The problem is difficult to help. The problem is not that no one cares enough to try.
You know, I think the heart of your critique that I found the most interesting, though, is the way that Tucker Carlson has come around to embracing something that we had normally associated with the left, or for the last generation with the left, which is this victim style politics.
Right.
That whatever the problems you face in your life, it's not your fault. You are not guilty. You are not responsible. It's someone else who is doing this to you. In this case, the elites, which is the mirror image of that culture of I am a victim that we had seen for so long, and that frankly, I had never expected to see conservatives embrace. I mean, maybe we were trending toward this. Everyone is a victim in American society. I actually wrote a book about this where, you know, that we had developed formulas where the only way you had moral credibility was to claim the victim card. The only way you would have any sort of authority or authenticity was to be a victim. But still, it is jarring to see the conservatives, so many conservatives, hear this victim politics populism and go, wow, that's deep. That's authentic. That's what we have been waiting for.
And I'm sure it has absolutely nothing to do with the fact that it was white working class voters who switched parties who helped put Trump in the White House. This is entirely a principled response to intense study of the relevant issue. No, I mean, look, it is jarring. It is jarring, and it's particularly jarring given the fact that, let's just be honest here, the victimhood of the argument for the victimhood of white working class and white middle class Americans is far less compelling than the argument for victimhood of, say, urban African Americans.
Right.
It's a less compelling argument,
but equally as seductive, though.
Very seductive.
Yeah.
It's very seductive because what it does is it creates a narrative. It creates a political narrative and give people power because you persuade human beings that if you vote for me, I will fix your problem. And, you know, it's the I alone can fix it mentality that Donald Trump said, which is sort of the GOP flip side of a lot of the Obama worship. You know, I remember very distinctly these YouTubes rocketing around conservative circles in the 08 campaign, where, say, a woman would say, Obama's going to make it easier for me to pay my mortgage or to, you know, make my car payment. And we're just laughing. Politics isn't going to be that powerful in your life. And then you have this Make America Great Again movement. I alone can fix it. I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. And you began to see the exact mirror where people were really looking to Donald Trump in these same adoring populist dependent way that people were looking at Barack Obama.
Well, and also it is an interesting phenomenon to watch this sort of ex post facto intellectual justification for Trumpism. Donald Trump comes down the escalator without really, I would say, a well-formed worldview, without a depth of principle. But there are people who are working really strenuously to somehow tack on some sort of a coherent intellectual superstructure onto Trumpism. And Tucker Carlson is certainly not the only one who's engaging in all of this.
Well, yeah, I absolutely. I mean, and that project was going on during the 2016 campaign itself. I remember debating some Notre Dame, and one of the arguments that I made, he was defending Trumpism, and I was saying essentially there Trumpism is not a thing. Trumpism, properly understood, is the ambition of one man, and he will say what he needs to say and do what he needs to do to get into power. That is Trumpism. But I think what's happening here is there is an effort to create an enduring right-wing populist movement. So this sort of trying to put an intellectual framework and trying to put an actual coherent framework around Trumpism, I think is an exercise in futility. But if you're trying to instead sort of say, let's change the GOP to be a particular kind of populist, right-wing populist entity, you see the logic for it, because otherwise what's going to happen to all the MAGA folks after Trump leaves office in 2021 or 2025? What then?
Well, you know, you also, though, get the arguments from people like Henry Olson, who will say that you can't have your cake and eat it, too, that if, in fact, you are pro-life and you support these conservative policies, then you simply have to go along with these questions of character and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Plug in whatever you want to plug in that you know, this is the key to the cake. You're going to have to eat this. You're going to you absolutely have to if you want to. And you are strongly pro-life, and you must get this pushback that, you know,
constantly.
Isn't this worth it? Well, you know, wouldn't you rather, you know, live in a country in which you know, babies are not aborted, you know, even if you have to put up with Donald Trump's tweets and his other infelicities.
Well, I have to eat nothing. Let me just say that. I you know, and again, you hear this all the time. Well, if you want this, then you have to that. No, I actually can make up my own mind about this, and I weigh this differently than some other people do. I get the good faith pro-life argument for supporting and voting for Donald Trump. However, I think in some ways it can be short-sighted. Here we are in 2019, the year before presidential year. Planned Parenthood is still funded. Roe is still the law of the land. There's not been a huge movement. There's been some good judicial nominees, but there's not been a huge movement one way or the other on the abortion needle. And here's my larger concern. My larger concern is that bad people can discredit good causes.
Yeah.
And that is something that I do not think folks have fully realized and fully internalized, because they have forgotten that the fundamental reality of the abortion argument is that it is not a legal argument. It is a cultural argument in this very important sense. You could overturn Roe tomorrow, but if there is a deep cultural commitment to abortion rights, abortion will still be legal everywhere or almost everywhere. In other words, you could achieve the generations-long legal imperative of the pro-life movement and still not necessarily put a dent in abortion if you have lost the cultural argument over life. And the thing that I would say about the cultural argument for life, which has been long the most powerful aspect of the pro-life movement, there's only been chipping away at Roe, just tiny chipping at the edges, and more than 40 years of political and cultural activism, but there has been real progress made in people's attitudes towards unplanned pregnancies and whether to bring babies to term. And how do we know this? Because we know that there are hundreds of thousands of fewer abortions per year with a larger population than there were in the years immediately following, or in some of the years following Roe v. Wade, with a smaller population of Americans. That's a tremendous success story. And I would hate to see the forward momentum of the cultural momentum of the pro-life movement arrested or reversed because the pro-life movement becomes tied to that man in the eyes of a significant number of Americans.
You know, I'm amazed that this hasn't gotten more attention, because you know what you're describing is winning the battles for hearts and minds. And I used to be very involved with Wisconsin Right to Life, and one of the things that they did, I was most impressed. You know, they pursued a political agenda, of course, but they also were putting up ads that were directly appealing to young women to make the choice for life. And they were very powerful. They were very empowering. And statistically, you could start to see that, in fact, they were getting some traction, that the needle was moving, that people were having fewer abortions. And this is exactly what you are talking about. If, on the other hand, this movement is eventually, you know, tagged as being, you know, fundamentally, you know, inhumane, it's going to take a very, very long time. You if you lose a generation, and again, one of the great success stories is, I mean, you and I both remember what we probably thought in the 1970s, that we thought no one's mind would ever be changed, that there was sort of the arc of history was toward more abortions, you know, more easily obtained. In fact, that hasn't happened, but that, that arc can be reversed, and I share that concern. Among the things that I also wanted to talk to you in the few minutes we have left, that I'm also, you know, and again, how many times have we sort of been surprised by our fellow conservatives? You've written about it, and I have a piece in the Bulwark today quoting you writing about it. This remarkable willingness of conservative Republicans to go along with the president's declaration of a national emergency in order to justify building the wall. And we don't need to go into, you know, the legality. You've broken it down, you know, all the questionable statutory authority and the constitutional questions. But the precedent that it would create, you would think that would give more folks pause, that in order to get this short-term political win, the weapon they would handle and to future presidents who are likely to be to the left is extraordinary. And they don't seem to, I guess maybe it is this sort of, you know, being caught up in the MAGA moment, that you have conservatives embracing an overreach that you would have thought that they would have instinctively recoiled from.
Yes. But, you know, what I think I'm noticing as a bipartisan disease is the incredible combination of short-term political thinking with long-term political arrogance.
Mm-hmm.
So we saw the Obama administration do a number of things that one would think a president would only do if he truly believed all of this coalition ascendant nonsense that essentially was saying that there's a blue wall that gives the Democrats a lock on the White House. Everything from, you know, pen and phone being one of the most notable, some of the most notable circumstances, right down to the way that, you know, he took upon himself immense military authority, just immense military authority beyond what George W. Bush did. And so you look at that and you said those are the decisions made by people who presume power. They're not cognizant, and it has not fully impacted them that they may lose it, and they may lose it quickly. I mean, one of the most notable examples is Harry Reid's nuking of the judicial filibuster.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Perfect example.
And so now what we have is MAGA land is making many of the same kinds of presumptions that, oh, well, this, you know, an emergency declaration is absolutely, don't talk to us about what Democrats could do. Because truth be told, you know, you drill down into a lot of the writing of the MAGA apologists, and these guys just, they like can't wait till 2020 until, you know, people like you and me are obliterated forever because Donald Trump is going to win, the populist tide is going to continue to roll, and because his victory was such a surprise in 2016, they just don't believe polls. Like, they just don't believe their actual data. And so they act as if this moment just will continue. And the fact of the matter is, it's going to end. It's going to end likely in 2021, certainly by 2025. And when it does, there's a lot of things that the Democrats will do empowered by particular precedents here. And I think that one of the worst of the precedents would be an emergency declaration. Let's not forget, there are Pentagon documents right now, you can find them, that list climate change as an immediate threat to national security.
Oh, sure.
So, I mean,
this is not a huge leap of imagination. This is not a huge leap of imagination to imagine a President Warren for example, you know, declaring a national emergency, and, you know, Lord knows what you would be able to do. Again, you don't have to be literal and cite the statute to realize that, you know, you've really changed, you know, I mean, you've really kind of changed the acceptable window of American politics.
Well, and think about this. Think of, and let's just not talk, let's not confine it to climate change. Gun violence.
Sure.
You know, if you can cite murders by illegal immigrants to support a emergency declaration and reallocations of funds, that you would then say that's essential, because this is the statutory standard, essential to the national defense. Well, what about if you, when you have death rates and murder rates that are higher than the death rates and murder rates you're articulating with in the immigration context? Well, is it not a national emergency as determined by recent presidential precedent to then deal with that in the gun violence realm? I mean, the possibilities here when you're always escalating your rhetoric to the point where everything's a national emergency, even relatively routine challenges that our nation has become, quote, a national emergency, then what you're doing is you're setting a precedent for a power grab that in many ways is more dangerous than DACA and DAPA. And I thought both DACA and DAPA that Obama did were extraordinarily unconstitutional power grabs. And here's why I say a little more dangerous, because the national emergency power grab, when tied to these specific statutes, brings it into the arena of national defense, mm-hmm. which is where presidential authority is at its absolute apex. And breaking through that wall in a situation that where there's no state of armed conflict and there's no declared war is, I think, a very dangerous move.
To see Lindsey Graham opening the door to this, who's the incoming chairman of the Judiciary Committee, is more than a little distressing. So, David, do you feel irrelevant these days? Of course, if you go on social media, you know, the guys like you and guys like me, that's probably one of the more acceptable words that's been thrown at us, that you're just out of step, you're just out of touch. and nobody wants to listen to this sort of thing, because, you know, it's all about MAGA. It's all about this culture war, that we're engaged in. And that, so do you feel irrelevant?
Look, I don't really think about things in those terms. I mean, I try to be faithful to the moment. What am I supposed to do as principally a Christian, secondarily a person of specific conservative convictions in this moment? And I'm kind of mad at my colleague and friend Jonah Goldberg for taking the podcast name The Remnant, because I loved it, and I love it for some theological reasons. If you look at scriptural history, time and time again, the body of people who are adhering to the truth, the body of people who are seeking to live according to the truth, has shrunk down in multiple circumstances in world history to the tiniest number of people. And the thing I like about this sort of remnant idea is that if there is a remnant, it does speak of a obvious sense of loss. I mean, it means that there mm-hmm. were once more people, now there's fewer people, but it also represents the seeds of renewal. And so if you look at those few thousand who had not bowed the knee to Baal in Elijah's time, if you look at the few people at the foot of the cross at Jesus's crucifixion, or the few people on the day of Pentecost, if you look at those tiny numbers, they represent a shrinking, a diminishing of a much larger whole. But in each circumstance, they were the seeds of renewal to something that was much greater that came later. And I think if we believe that our conservative ideas, our Christian ethics, if those things have real power, if they're true in a fundamental sense, then just keeping the lamp lit a little bit is of real value. And it might not be of real value right away. I mean, I don't think you can judge the health of, you can't judge the merit of any given idea by its number of followers in a snapshot of life. But I think the value of these convictions will be demonstrated over time.
David, I can't top that. I cannot follow that. I am desperate for signs of hope, and you've provided me with more than a little bit. I want to thank you for joining me and all the time you've spent with us, and thank you for listening to the Daily Bulwark podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow. We'll try to do this all over again.